As if it weren't enough to have to follow one good act, our next speaker, Ernest Vandenhagen, has to follow two. I was a little concerned before we came in because I had never met Ernest personally before today. I knew Henry Hazlitt and Milton Friedman. And I was a little concerned that perhaps I had to give a different kind of introduction. But then as I came through the assembled crowd this evening, four or five occasions I heard someone asking someone else, "Who is this fellow Hazlitt and Friedman on the program with Vandenhagen?" He's a lecturer in sociology and psychology at the New School for Social Research, adjunct professor of social philosophy at NYU, a psychoanalyst in private practice, an economist, perhaps I should say by avocation, but by excellence anyway, former Guggenheim Fellow, author of four books, the most recent of which is a book entitled The Jewish Mystique, which occurred to me that perhaps he'd been eating a lot of Levy's rye bread, because apparently he learned that you don't have to be Jewish to cash in on the market for Jewish books.
You revealed my trick. I disagree a little bit with Milton and a little bit with Mr. Hazlitt, which puts me in an uncomfortable position. I will start with my disagreements with Milton. There are two in number, but before I explain wherein they consist, I should like to go to the root of them, and the root is simply that Milton is excessively rational. A sin that no one will ever accuse me of having committed. Not only is Milton excessively rational, but he compounds this by projecting his rationality on other people and assuming that they too are rational. Now, this assumption, of course, places him into a dilemma. For people do not accept Milton's system. Now, if people are rational, why don't they accept Milton's system? Only because it is not rational, or they are not rational. So one of the two points in Milton's ideas must be wrong. Either his own system is not rational enough to be accepted by rational people, or people are not rational enough to accept a system by Milton Friedman. Major disagreement I have with Milton is this, that I do agree on the basic outlines of the negative income tax. I would agree fully with Henry that it is not a good system, but I think it is the best. The point is that if we could start over altogether, I think I would do without it and could figure out something better. But if we if we are confronted with the concrete alternatives, Milton's system is the only one that offers any sort of incentive to those on any form of relief. So in some form or other, I would certainly like to see it adapted. In almost any form, it would be an improvement. There are two qualifications I have to it. Milton, to save money, wishes to do something that seems at first blush quite reasonable. Namely, he says that poor people, just like rich people, hand in an income tax return. Once in a while, there will be an accounting, of course, as there is for rich people. But if their income is below a certain amount, they will be entitled to this negative income tax supplement. Now, it seems to me that this disregards two major facts about the poor. First, that most of them are, as it were, pre-industrial in their mentality. That is, say, unlike people who have an income to declare, a positive income, they are not accustomed to calculate, to deal in a certain business-like way with the government. I say pre-industrial not only because I want to be polite and say, and don't want to avoid saying that they are more inclined to cheating than other people, but because this is historically correct. For instance, in not highly industrialized countries, such as, say, Italy, you find it is a generally accepted sport to try to cheat the government. No one takes it seriously as it just costs more money. It isn't efficient, you see. In an industrial system, people have come to the conclusion that it is more inefficient on the whole to declare their income with a fair degree of honesty. So the temptation will be great, the mentality will be present, and perhaps most important, whereas there is a sanction available, and that threat of the sanction, or the threat of that sanction, may be deterrent. For a person who cheats on his positive income, I do not think there are any real sanctions available to a person who would cheat on his negative income. Suppose, for instance, you have a mother of three children who is entitled to a negative income tax, and suppose she cheats and declares four children or five. Suppose then in this accounting she is discovered. What are we going to do with her? A fine, she has no money to pay it. Put her in jail, what will we do with the children? In effect, therefore, such a person is likely to anticipate, and rightly so, that by cheating she can only gain. If she succeeds, she's getting the money. If she doesn't succeed, all that will happen to her is that she's not getting the money. In effect, everyone will cheat. Let me say once more that if you have a positive income, there are sanctions available against you, apart from you having usually a somewhat different mentality. That is one thing. So that I do not think we can really, whether we call it still negative income tax and just have more frequent accountings and so on, is a semantic matter, but I do not think we can treat the persons who declare a negative income quite as we do the persons who declare a positive one. Secondly, it seems to me that Milton has given too static a picture. The poor are a group of people who are poor. His picture has been dynamic only in the one respect, namely he wants fewer of them to be poor. The incentive will make some of them work out of it. But there is also another kind of possible dynamic effect, namely people may be attracted to being poor. That is, they may decide, however low the income is, that they prefer to not work and have that low income rather than to work for a higher income. This basically depends, of course, on the value they place on their leisure versus money income, which value differs from person to person, can be influenced by some degree of manipulation. But if you look at such a thing as, for instance, the hippies, which are a group of middle-aged youngsters, now probably middle-aged youngsters, I meant to say middle-class youngsters, you do find that a considerable number of them forsake income-earning activities for the same sake of leisure, even if that involved a certain amount of financing. How many in the future, if you guarantee a minimum income, will be attracted to this? Or will most likely simply stop working regularly and just work once in a while when they decide they want something and then not work, which is quite usual again in pre-industrial cultures. How many, I do not know, but I think the problem has to be considered, and particularly considered in the light of one experience we have with the welfare system. As you all know, the greatest segment of welfare recipients now are dependent children and their mothers. This is a relatively new feature of the welfare system. It was originally introduced, if my memory does not deceive me, to help the children of widowed minors in various states who, because of the death of their fathers, were left without means. Now 52% of all the recipients are dependent children. It is hard to imagine that anyone would want to have children for the sake of, or because of, or in view of welfare payments. But the fact is that, on the one hand, as Milton pointed out, because the welfare system put a premium on fathers abandoning children, but on the other hand, these families were to begin with, not living even with the father present, on an income that would be viable or decent and so on. It seems to me that there is some reasonable suspicion that the very fact that this money was available caused these children to come into existence who otherwise would not have come into existence. Similarly, I suspect that if the principles adopted as Milton proposes it, not as Mr. Nixon, incidentally, has proposed it, because he does wish to make sure that people will work and so on. I do not know how well Mr. Nixon's system works, will work in this respect, but the point is that he imposes a legal obligation, and we will see what can be done to carry out that legal obligation or enforce it. But at least there's a legal obligation. As Milton has it, if you have an income below a certain amount of money, you will get this negative income tax, and no one will ask you to work or not to work. It relies entirely on the fact that that income is so low that people will be rational enough to decide that it would be a good idea to supplement it by working. I do not think people are quite that rational, and I do think they may find it easier to make a lot of fuss to increase their income from the same source from which they're getting it, namely from the government. So in this respect, I would tend to agree with Mr. Hazlitt. There is one, this exhausts on the whole, I think, my disagreement with Milton, fortunately. There is one point I want to raise about Mr. Hazlitt's view here, namely, if I understand him correctly, and please correct me if I don't, what you want to do, Henry, is to make sure that in addition to people getting money, they also get social work. However you call it, you say there should be people who make sure why this family needs money and who guide that family, possibly in such a way as to lead it to be more cautious, prudent, reasonable, and so on.
Not necessarily, but withhold or give the money on these people.
Yes, all right. Yeah. But that would, I mean, yeah. If you want to withhold it, you have to make a judgment. Yeah. If you have to make a judgment, you have to determine, someone has to determine, is that family acting reasonably, and possibly to help them to act more reasonably. Now, the only point I have to make on this is that there's absolutely no evidence that families guided by social workers have in any way performed better than families not so guided. None whatever. If it could be shown, and that wouldn't be so hard to set up a controlled experiment in a reasonable way, that social work actually leads to some change. Social work reinforced by possibly withholding, rewarding, and so on, any way you want it. That it actually leads to some change in the family lifestyle and so on, I think I could be much more easily persuaded to do this. Now, we have to carefully distinguish. What I am proposing is to check whether the family has the income it declares, as we now check with Internal Revenue matters. I am not proposing to give the family compulsory social work. This does not exclude, of course, Henry, that we may have institutions in which advice would be available to families who so wanted and who would pay a fee out of perhaps the money that they are getting in the form of some form of negative income tax to get this advice. But I think advice not got and paid for on a voluntary basis, advice, so to speak, imposed by a social worker, is advice that is likely to be evaded to begin with. And social work is extremely costly. It is a major reason why the poor get so little percentage of what is being spent for them. There are many other reasons, too. Now, to end on another agreement issue, I do think it is very unlikely that that the negative income tax will take the place of all the programs that it ought to take the place of. I do not think that one can really seriously hope that it will. So the question that arises before us is, if it doesn't, is it still a good idea to replace what is now called welfare payments? On the whole, with the amendment I have suggested, namely that one should check on the income declaration, I think it is, because it seems to me that we are doing quite everything that the negative income tax does by giving people money, even though we don't say it in so many words, we do give them money now without checking whether they can or want to work. And on this last point, I wish to merely mention to you that there are lots of statistics that seem to indicate that most people on welfare are actually disabled and cannot work. I would, in the first place, there are 2 points to be made. Even if only a very small percentage can work, that percentage has to be multiplied by their dependents. And so if the whole family gets off the welfare roll, it is quite a greater number of people than seems to be the case. And secondly, I have to add, and I have to add it with some regret, practically all the statistics we know on the nature of welfare recipients, their abilities and disabilities, are probably deceptive, to put it politely. In other words, the social workers cheat. This can be shown. I don't. There is anyone who knows a little bit about statistics and considers the various statistics offered in terms of internal consistency. And this is now being done, for instance, in New York and so on, can very clearly see that there has been a large element of calling people disabled or unemployable and so on, who turn out to be entirely employable for reasons that can be clearly shown from the figures. In short, if you put it this way, I think that there are certainly people who are in poverty for reasons beyond their control, but I think the system that we have tends to lead a number of people to become professionally poor because it is the most convenient and the most profitable way for them to live. So what I would propose is that we adapt Milton's proposals basically with the amendment that we check both on employability and on the actual income far more harshly than Milton himself would favor. And I think that Milton is thinking of this in terms of economically, that the checking is a very expensive process and that some cheating might be worth tolerating rather than spending the money on the checking, which I think is entirely true if you look at the metastatically. If you assume that is that this very fact of not checking will not increase the amount of cheating, will not attract people to the status of poor, will not be a disincentive. I'm afraid it will be. Thank you.